What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. Our Resistance in Residence artist this week is multi-hyphenated artist Candace Johnson. Welcome to the show, Candace.
Thank you so much.
And I had to say multi-hyphenated, and we'll get into it, because I looked at your bio and I was like, oh, she does all of the things. Let's start with a little bit about you, where and how you grew up and what your family was like.
Sure. I was raised in Tennessee, born in South Bend, Indiana, but didn't know anything about it. I was about 6 months old when my parents moved back to the South, and raised in a loving, very loving family. I have 5 siblings, 2 are deceased. I was the youngest of the 6 and basically had 5 other parents. They were old enough to be my parents. There was only one sibling living in the home with me, and I would say he was one of my first maybe artistic inspirational people. He would play the piano and make up stories while he was playing the piano, and he would play the piano in a way that intensified the drama of the story that he was making up. And a child is going up the steps, and then you play piano and it would sound ominous. And, you know, I loved it. Who would know that years later I would be doing something very similar, but in a different way. I grew up in a Christian home, started singing in church like many of my brothers and sisters. I had a different kind of voice. My mom was my first voice coach, and she didn't have any formal training herself, but she just knew how to tell me to use my voice. And she would say, "Hey, Candace, don't hit that note so hard. You need to smooth your way into it." Well, years later, I would understand that a lot of what she was giving me was bel canto, classical approach to singing. Yeah, and she knew that I didn't have the kind of voice that could sing Aretha very authentically and well. But I could, as I grew older, I could sing some Whitney Houston. Another thing about my musical upbringing, because it was a Christian family, we were a Christian family, my mom would not allow me to sing love songs until I was about 14, because she said, "You don't know that kind of love yet." So so I was singing Bill and Gloria Gaither, "Jesus, I Heard You Had a Big House." I was singing hymns. And my church was a more conservative Black Baptist church. And so we did a lot of hymns and spirituals and some of the gospel, like Andre Crouch. Hallelujah, hallelujah, we're going to see the King. And some of the wine and things. And I sang pretty straight, you know, no color, no soul. And when I was 14 and starting to sing some of the love songs, and my peers would say, "Well, not only why do you talk the way you talk, but why do you sing like you sing?" And I didn't really have an answer for that. Then I would, maybe around 16, I did my first demo tape then, and the producer said he was working with CeCe Winans, and I thought this was, oh, this is my ticket into the industry. And we've been gave me all of these songs to learn and try to sound just like the singer, so I could really develop my own sense of artistry. And it didn't work. I'm in the studio and he's asking me to sing, well, put some heart, some soul in it. And I just didn't have it. And I'm gonna say this today, I can say this, and this is something that I've just come to. I look back at that time and I realize, because I was quite sheltered growing up. My parents knew that, the struggle was real, but they didn't want me to experience the struggle. So they tried to keep me almost unaware of it. And I think that a part of that didn't allow me to come in contact emotionally and even intellectually with what struggle is. And that soulfulness that our people have, it comes from struggle. It comes from knowing, like it's almost like it embedded in our voices. And I didn't have that experience. And just recently, I was having this impulse to sing and to write music and just kind of express myself musically. And I said, oh, I know a pain now that I've never known. And I can sing with a soulfulness that I've never approached before because of that.
Yeah, I was so when you said Tennessee, I went ooh, because I love Tennessee. It's so beautiful, and I'm partly biased because the Highlander Center is there, and so I went once for a conference. It was in Memphis, and I went to the Civil Rights Museum, which I just thought was amazing. And so the second time I had a chance to go there, I brought my daughter, and my daughter said. New Market, Tennessee. It's New Market. My daughter said, why are there so many Confederate flags? And she knew what those flags meant. She was terrified. And so I guess that's a really long-winded way of me saying, you grew up in the South. How was that pain of blackness not part of your experience? I mean, I love that for you. And I also, it's just, I'm curious.
That's a great question. So I think about my mom's jobs before she even had children. She was cleaning for a white family. Once my parents were married, she was doing some cleaning and organizing for a white family. She even told me that the way she learned how to fold clothes was because this white family that she was working for taught her how to do this, and she passed that on to me. And the struggle that she and my dad experienced, I think by the time I had come along, they had five children, and then I was the last, right? So the oldest was 22, and then I come along. The one closest to me was 15, but no longer living with them. And my parents were in a different place financially. So they were able to shelter me by providing private school education where all I had to do was focus on school. I remember being in third grade. I was in a play in the community theater, and I saw this white gentleman that my father worked with. Both my parents are black. My father worked with this gentleman, and I went up to him during rehearsal and I said, oh, hi, Mr. So and so. And he looked appalled that I would speak to him. And I was like, oh, that's so weird. What's wrong with what happened? And I just kind of sauntered off, like a kid would. And I told my parents, and they explained to me this is the first memory that I have encountering racism. And they explained to me, well, not everybody is ready for what the civil rights movement brought for us. Not everybody's ready for a black person to just come and approach them and say hello. And I was befuddled, but just accepted it. Like, okay, and I put it in the back of my mind, but it was in the back of my mind. I didn't carry it in the forefront. I think my parents really wanted to instill in me that everything was possible to me if I believed, if I put my mind to something, I could do it. They didn't talk to me about what obstacles might lay ahead because I was black.
I'm gonna ask you a controversial question, and this is something you push back on. Well, maybe not controversial. I'm really fascinated by this conversation. Do you remember, or was there a time? Let me not put life events into your life that you haven't shared with me, because I wasn't walking in your shoes. Was there a time when, so that was the first time, right, that you'd experienced white folks whiting. Do you remember a time when you realize, oh, my blackness is actually a thing, and this is something I'm gonna have to contend with as I move through the world?
So I'm going to point to, this is in the same time period, I'm going to point to a friendship that I had with a white young lady. I was in a private school where there were probably a total of 200 students from Montessori to 12th grade, and about 12 of us were black. And there was no diversity in my hometown of Jackson at that time. I remember my mom having a conversation, perhaps with the other mom, about the we wanted to have a sleepover at her house, and there seemed to be this concept of my mom asking, are you sure you're okay with this? We're a black family. I remember that, and then when the time was for her to come to my house, I felt this sense of my parents understood that our neighborhood was different, our home was different, and questioning, like, would she be comfortable coming into this environment? So I it wasn't put out front for me, but it's something that I just remember having, just a little bit of a residual taste in my mouth, like, And here's where that came full circle. When I went to college, you do a lottery and you find out who your roommate is going to be in your freshman year. I read the name of my roommate, and I said her first name was Emily, her last name was Scone. Everything about that said to me, more than likely this person is white. And I felt it was imperative that I call her right away and explain to her that I'm black, and please let me know now if that's going to be a problem so I can make the proper adjustments. And she responded with, "Huh, why would that be a problem?" She was from Seattle, and maybe grew up in a home where that wasn't a thing. But it was clear it could be an issue. And it's interesting. I'm so glad that you asked me the question because I can't really trace other specific moments, but I know that there is this undercurrent that this could be an issue.
I mean, I just find it. I mean, we really do need to get to talking about your show and the art. And right, I mean, you started really beautifully, sort of talking about the way how you moved through the world, impacted at least one of your art forms. But I'm fascinated by the different ways that Black folks experience Blackness, based on where we live, our families, North, South, et cetera. So. And the impacts of white supremacy are so insidious, sometimes we don't even realize it until the trauma comes up. So you do some amazing things in the world, and one of them is that you are a voice coach for the Formerly Incarcerated People's Performance Project, FIPPP. Oh, I've never heard of these folks, and I want to have them on the show. Who are they, and what do they do?
Well, it's a wonderful program that allows formerly incarcerated people to be in a program for, I want to say, 2 to 3 years, where they become a fellow in the program and they are taught how to take their stories, whether that be stories, in incarceration or just their upbringing, whatever stories they want to tell, that they have a voice that is worth being heard, and they teach them how to tell the stories in a compelling way. So we work on not only the stories, but how to make the stories more artful. How, for me as a voice coach, I'm working with them on how to project, you know, very simple things sometimes. But also this Sunday, in fact, is going to be my first session teaching this summer. And we're talking about being big and bold and how our voice is a reflection of our inner workings. And if we don't have that sense of being bold internally, it's not going to show up in the voice.
July is Mental Health Awareness Month. Let's get back to talking about you. And you have a piece that is playing at the Marsh called Scatterbrain. What is the piece about?
Well, let's talk about the title first. So
yeah,
scat, it's scat-T-E-R, because it incorporates the scatterbrainness of having ADHD and also the musical aspect, using scatting as a musical way to depict that kind of scattered harriedness of the brain activity, but we can represent it musically with scatting. Scatting can also just represent, hey, I'm just having thoughts. And so that's what I do throughout the show is I will scat. And the scat is that it's the undercurrent of there's always something spinning around in the mind. I think as an artist, I think that's always true. I'm always taking in things and thinking how can, ooh, this is a show. Oh, this is a scene. This is a character. But then there's just the everyday life things that are happening. And so yeah, scatterbrained, the music of ADHD. We tend to think of ADHD. It has in its acronym, it has the word disorder, attention hyperactivity deficit disorder. But truly, that D is not even accurate. It's not a disorder. It is a developmental, neurological developmental presentation, but not a disorder. So that's one of the things that I highlight in the show, to just help us change our perspective. And for me as an artist, it's part of my golden juice that makes me work. So it's in, you know, in everyday life, it can also be a challenge. But when I'm on stage and I'm multitasking, reading the audience, and I am delivering the lines, and I'm in characters, and I'm doing movement, all of those things require different aspects of the brain being engaged. And that's my flow state. So the show basically is about my being diagnosed later in life with inattentive ADHD and realizing, oh, that's why X, Y, Z, A, B, C, and 1, 2, 3. A lot of things start to make more sense. I then go back in the show and I start to cover my childhood all the way through, I think, having my first child and starting to come into an understanding of, oh, okay, this thing that is called a disorder, actually, if I, you know, look at it from this perspective, this is part of why I am and how I am, who I am, and just walking away with a sense of confidence and owning the difference of my neurological makeup, rather than, you know, saying, oh, woe is me, something is wrong. And as I go through these different parts of periods of my life, the story is told through a life coach, through a therapist. They're like the instigators who get me to recall these stories. So I play about 7 characters in this show.
Oof. Of that, I know that life. I did a show about a woman show about the murder of Natasha McKenna in Fairfax,
Ooh.
Virginia. Nine
Ooh.
characters in 60 minutes. It's a ride. It's a ride to be up there by yourself, and it's such a particular skill set, and I can't wait to drag my bae to come check you out. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm gonna put you on the spot
Okay.
because you can sing all kinds of ways, and I'm wondering if you could just give us a little taste of you. I don't know if you want a scat or a little a cappella, whatever. I'd love to just bless my audience with what they could be blessed more with if they come see your show.
All right. So I'm going to have you put something into this. Give me something that you want your audience to feel right now.
Hope.
Hope. I have hope. I have hope. I have hope that we can abide in unity. Now, if I start to sing high, it might clip out. I have hope. I have hope. Oh, I have hope for us.
Wow. Thank you. That was a blessing beyond even what I expected the blessing to be.
Oh.
That was beautiful. And I'm hoping that I know it did. I know it touched my listeners the way it touched me. Yeah, I got, my people are, a lot of our folks are in deep angst and agony right now. And
Yes.
I every chance I get, I'm trying to remind people we're going to be all right.
Yes.
It's not time to agonize. It's time to organize. And a lot of us, this is what we've been trained for. So it's just time to get busy. And this is the last of it. White supremacy
Yes.
is gasping for air on its deathbed. We're gonna
You're
be all
right.
right. We're gonna be all right. Yeah, and I will say, so I've got a co-founder of my organization, Taha Ak, and he says, and some of my listeners have heard this, he says, white supremacy is on its deathbed, gasping for breath, and now it's our job to put our knee on its chest and cover its nose and mouth
Ooh.
and finish the job.
Woo.
That's what right now is. And you can take that to in any which way, right? We all got a role to play in the movement, and artists are such a piece of what has to happen right now. There is no movement, there is no revolution without artists. And if you could talk about that just for a little while, and then I'm gonna ask you to tell people where they can come check you out.
Sure. So I see art both as education and resistance, and I feel like you can't really disentangle the two. And some of us will go in with the fire and the heat in your face, and some of us will go in and they will taste the fire in their mouths after they have eaten the meal. And that's where I think I come in. My presentation is often sweet and colorful. It has, sunshine. Even the tonality of my voice, I understand, communicates sweetness, and I can be powerful, but there's this abiding sweetness in my artistic presence. But I know that the way I write and the intensity with which I give information through my characters, I know that people are feeling fire. And it's a fire that they may get a little, oof, that was hot. But the real burn comes after when they chew on the things that they saw. And that's where I believe the personal change comes about.
I love that. All right, Candace, tell the people where they can find you and witness what you're bringing to the marsh this month.
Oh, thank you so much. So the show Scatterbrain, the music of ADHD, is running at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley from Saturday, July 19th through September 13th. And so that's every Saturday for those 2 months, with the exception of the Saturday of Labor Day. I will be there, and I'm looking forward to seeing people in the seats and after the show. That's where the best conversations happen. So please come and support me and tell friends about it. If you think you know someone that could have ADHD or may be toying with the idea that, oh, something's different, I'm struggling, I can't seem to get myself started, or I can't finish, this might be a show that could change their life.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.